even at the risk of leaving out many others, special welcome to Joel and Gayla, to Melody, to Larry, and a word to Morgan. I would like to hear you read again. Most of you were here last week, but for those who were not, in this month that was dedicated to parables, we talked about the prodigal son, the boy who left home, went to hell in a handbasket, woke up one day to good sense, and came back to his waiting father. He had an I'm sorry speech already, but his father was so glad to see him that he got no chance to deliver it. The father said, get out the best linen and silver, break open the choicest wine, spare no expense, my son who was lost is found, we're going to party tonight. But while all this was happening, there was another boy whom I barely mentioned last week, an older brother, hard at work out in the fields, digging turnips or cultivating corn, getting most of his grim satisfaction in life out of his conviction that he was better than other people. You have all known somebody like him, totally respectable, always reliable, but so uptight they squeak when they walk, people with hard eyes, lips drawn down in a little curve of disgust for the rest of us who do not work as hard as they do, people who would never rob a bank or run off with somebody else's wife or husband, but people you just can't bear to be around. If somebody calls, we're having a party tonight, and the elder brother is coming, you say to your spouse, let's have two headaches and miss this one. You know the type. Full, right up to the eyeballs with sour goodness. Well, this particular member of that clan is out there in the field where all good, hard-working boys are supposed to be. And as he comes trudging in with heavy steps, his whole body posture a kind of rebuke to the world for the hard work it makes him do, he hears the sound of music and dancing. He calls a servant and grinds out a question through clenched teeth. Will you please tell me what is going on in this house? While his face says, how dare anybody have a party without my approval? The poor servant stammers out that the kid brother has come back home, and everybody's celebrating with wine and ribs, music and dancing. You would expect a brother, if he had any love at all in his heart, to drop the hoe, forget how tired he was, and lunge into that house with so much joy that he would practically knock his brother down. But not this guy. The party makes him so mad that he won't even go in. He skulks around outside, pouting, kicks the dog, grumbling under his breath about irresponsible kids who run off and do anything they damned well please, and then come home, can you believe it, to a party. Can you honestly say you've never felt like that? Never been miffed when your good, decent life seemed forgotten in the happy welcome of some reprobate come late to his senses? So the father, who earlier in the day has run down the road to welcome his wayward son, now takes the initiative again and comes outside to plead with his respectable son. And when we eavesdrop on that conversation, we discover how it is possible to do good and be bad, to keep every law and perform every duty and still be a million light years away from the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of right relationships. I guess you know, the son said, who stayed home but was lost as completely as his absent brother. I guess you know how I slaved for you all these years. I never disobeyed your orders, and you never once gave me a party like this. But now that he turns up, after he spent good money on whores and street bums, you kill the choicest steer, and you go out and hire a band. The father can hardly believe it. My son, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. How could we help celebrating tonight? Your brother was dead, and here he is, come back to life. And oddly, at this critical moment, the curtain falls. The story has no real end. It just runs on forlornly and falls off at last into silence. On purpose, I think, so that we have to ask ourselves, what is wrong here? Until we find a kind of terror in the story. It says there are good people whose goodness never makes them generous or happy. I spent years of my life among people ordered by their religion to be in church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. Some of them, perhaps in some places even most of them, went gladly, but many went reluctantly. And I knew this because I heard them complain about it, especially about the ones who didn't show up. It was always a curious thing to me. It was as if they had to endure some kind of punishment, and they wanted to be sure others shared their misery. They sometimes asked me to stand in the pulpit and castigate those who did not make it three times a week. I could never reconcile myself to that. It seemed to me that if we had a good thing going, a banquet experience, a fellowship that counted enormously when we were sick or discouraged, then we would simply be glad when others came, and when they didn't, it wouldn't be grumbling we thought of, but a quiet regret that they had missed something so wonderful. People who are really happy where they are never grumble because others are missing out. They only regret it, and they are hopeful that what enriches them so much may be shared somehow by more. So there were two lost sons in that house, as it turns out. One of them ate the husks of fleshliness. The world has its share of those sons and daughters. The other ate the rancid food of a cost-counting mind. And you can find his kin in every institution. You find one son in a tavern, drinking too much, or in the brothel, trying to buy a moment of love, And you find the other one sometimes in the middle of church, going through all the motions of devotion and service, forgetting how to laugh, envying people who seem to be having a better time outside than he is inside, and determined, if the chance ever comes, to see that they don't get off scot-free. Part of the older brother syndrome in this story is that he apparently thought he could buy a relationship. If he worked hard enough and refrained from certain things, his father would owe him love, more love than to anyone else. But the message of this homespun tale is that you can't buy love. You can only accept it happily. There are people in churches, I think, who have never learned that. They offer work instead of themselves. There is a vast difference. In the words of a famous mystic, they desert him by entering his service instead. Constant busyness becomes a drug to help them forget that they have never really accepted the relationship, never quite surrendered themselves. Apparently, the one thing Jesus could not stand was self-righteousness, the arm permanently bent from patting its own back. That older son felt a little more secure in his father's good opinion the day after his younger brother left home. Can there be anyone in this room who hasn't, in some context, in some moment, felt that way? The game we're best at is called contrast. And the way we play it is to find somebody, wife, child, friend, whose failures by contrast with ours make us feel good. The basic rule of the game is to hunt a weakness where we happen to be strong. That is, if I am stingy, I take care never to contrast that with your generosity. I contrast my boldness to your timidity, or my church loyalties to your indifference. And by picking the basis for the contrast, I always win. I keep hunting until I find some little room in the house of my days that I keep better than anybody else, and then I hang a plaque in my own honor. If I have any trouble being superior to my friends, I can always look down at the street people and congratulate myself on how wisely and well I've lived my life, and give them a dollar and walk on, untroubled by the mystery of things. Not many of us can find it in our hearts to say, and really mean it, there but for the grace of God and luck of birth and choice of parents and friends supporting and good health and a great, great deal of good luck, there go I. We are not that honest, and we are not that strong. And Christianity, the real thing, is the toughest act in the world. I don't mean church going, which is easy enough, but the mandate that says I must not feel that secret little joy, at least I must not act on it when somebody trips who has put me down. That if I do feel it, I should be ashamed and deliberately try to act better than I feel. Paul said it better than anybody. Love is never glad because others go wrong. Think of the elder brother when you hear those words. Love is only made glad by goodness. That's the only thing that makes it glad. Always slow to expose. Slow to expose. Always eager to believe the best. Do you think that's easy advice to follow? Sentimental stuff? Don't kid yourself. Those are words of so tough a fiber that only the strongest people ever even come close to what they demand. When was the last time you and I were sure that we could describe ourselves as always eager to believe the best? What we more often do is charge other people with doing what we would do given the chance. There is no mention in our story of the prodigal son's consorting with prostitutes, but the elder brother assumes he had. And if the charge had been true, pity, not sullen, self-righteous anger, but pity was what he should have felt. Pity for a boy, his own brother, who knew so little of mutual love that he had to buy it. And then you wonder if he thinks of buying a woman's love because his own deep and hidden mind knew that he had tried for years to buy his father's love. I'm always surprised by the failure, even of church members, to adopt the value standards Christ demonstrated over and over. He was almost shockingly patient with people whose failures grew out of weaknesses of the flesh. He never pretended they could indulge themselves without hurt to themselves, potentially great harm to others, but he was gentle and soft-spoken, never as angry with them as he was with people who were quick to stab someone in the back and let the blood of reputation spill out, jealous, intolerant, corroded with envy, and worst, always worst of all, smug and positive that they are better than the rest of us. He measured wrongs so differently from the way we do. What he disliked, many of us do so often that if the state punished accordingly, we'd be in prison. How strange it is that if a woman steals a loaf of bread, she may go to jail. But if my constant bad temper steals happiness from an entire family, robs the eyes of my own children of innocence, nothing is said by the state, and probably the crime, the intangible crime, goes on and on until the children can grow up and escape. Make it stick in your heads, please. In the judgment of Jesus, sins of the disposition sins of the Spirit, are even more dangerous and deadly than sins of the flesh. Gossip, worse than gluttony. Pride, more dangerous than pot. Pious hypocrisy, more deadly than drunkenness. Do you know why? God knows the failures of the flesh cause enough heartbreak and anguish in this world. But the sins of the Spirit, malice, prejudice, swollen arrogance, are deeper dugouts for hiding from the invasion of God than all the scandalous behavior in the world. Where is the AA for curing suspicious, nasty minds? Well, it's only a parable, after all. And no parable can say everything, but let's be honest about the ending. It ends with the younger son, for all his follies, inside the house, and the older boy outside, alone and in the dark. It is a stunning reversal of our usual judgments. Here was a stay-at-home, go-to-church son who had always done everything that could be expected of him, probably never strayed more than 3 fields away from his house. Yet all the time, he had been living in a far country, cut off from the real meaning of love, working for the wrong reasons, respectable only because he lacked the courage to be otherwise. Reluctantly good. No wonder he couldn't stand the sound of music from inside the house. There hadn't been a song in his heart for years. Only the sound of a calculator adding up his own virtues. Every member of every church needs to hear the honest response of one student of this parable who was asked his opinion of the identity of the elder brother. I learned it only yesterday, he said. Myself.